It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A unique and inclusive park is coming to La Crosse. Construction is underway to turn Train Park into an all-abilities park where individuals of all ages who have cognitive, sensory, or other physical challenges can safely play. When finished, it'll be the first of its kind in the state. We talk with the president of the project about the need for such a space in La Crosse, as well as what an all-abilities park looks like. Fran Formanek is president of the All Abilities Train Park Project. Fran, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning, John. Thank you for inviting us to be on.
Oh, first of all, can you describe what an All Abilities Park is?
Well, one of the things that it's not is putting a bunch of playground equipment in one little area and then letting people that have some type of disability utilize it. In this case, our park is very unique in that it's made up very much like a Disney World kind of theme way that there'll be about seven different zones in it. Each one of them have a different specialty kind of thing for the children to play on. For example, there'll be sliding zone, a swinging zone, we're going to have a zip line zone, we'll have youth and theater along with that. So it's a very unique situation that we've decided to go with. There's very few of them in the world, much less in the United States. Especially in our region, there is none that is going to compare to this beautiful park.
Now, I can understand including playground equipment that's accessible to an individual in a wheelchair, for example, but this concept also takes into account individuals with cognitive or sensory challenges. So what are the big differences between an ADA-compliant park and an all-abilities park?
This project was actually born about 7 years ago by a number of parents that had autistic children or have autistic children. And they didn't have anywhere to go because every so often the children would take off and they couldn't control them. And so they ended up taking them down to a dog park because it was fenced in. And so when you look at the park that we're putting together, every piece of equipment is made so that, like you said, anybody with autism or in that spectrum or anybody that is disability of any kind can utilize that equipment. And so this park is so much different than just an ADA park. Our park director, Steve Caroline, when he first got involved in it, he said, well, all of my parks are ADA compliant. Well, that's true. But the parks that we're putting together here, this park, is so much different because it gives the ability for people with disabilities, autism, and those that are wheelchair-bound to be able to utilize this equipment more so than the equipment that is in the ADA park. An ADA park basically amounts to that, you know, a person can go into the park, but in reality, a lot of the equipment that's in there cannot be used by that individual. And that's the difference between our park and the ADA park. Our equipment is specially made, some of it costing as much as $25,000 to be able to be used for people with disabilities of any kind.
So how do you ensure safety in a park like this?
Well, one of the things that obviously we're going to be utilizing the university and the technical school and the two hospitals as far as utilizing their employees that deal with people that have these disabilities. And they're actually going to be a teaching process involved in the park itself so that, you know, we have trained individuals that will be working with the children, but also, of course, their parents.
Once completed, this will be, as you mentioned, the only all-abilities park in Wisconsin and one of only a handful in the United States. Does that speak to the challenges in getting a park like this off the ground?
Absolutely. You know, and again, we thought right off the bat that we would make this park something unusual as far as the region, in fact, the Midwest. About one of the only parks that we looked at is in California, called Magic Bridge, and we didn't design our park like that, but in a way we utilized some of the ideas. Our subcommittee on equipment has been working diligently for months on end, you know, tweaking this and changing that to a point where now we're at a point that we're going to be bidding it out as far as the park itself. Now, as you said before, we have had a groundbreaking, and that'll be the start of the buildings that are going to be utilized for the park itself. The park itself is sitting on about 2.7 acres of a part of the train park itself is about almost 7 acres itself. But on the part that we're going to be utilizing, it's about 2.7 acres for this fantastic park that we're putting together.
So what's the timeline? How soon could there be children playing in the new and improved train park?
The bids are going out, and you know, the building part will be taking place within the next couple of weeks as far as the start is concerned. But as far as the playground itself, we're looking at more at the fall of 2019.
I know this might be getting ahead of things a little bit, but do you hope to include more All Abilities parks in the La Crosse area?
Well, this park is so unique that was a question that one of the ladies that works at a place called Aptiv said, well, how come you can't do this at every park? Well, this is such a unique situation that it's going to be a centralized area throughout the city of La Crosse. And so right now, you know, we're focusing on just this one.
So have you heard about interest from other parts of the state about doing something else like this?
Absolutely. I'm hearing some things that they're talking about. I see in Wausau, they're starting a project, something similar, not in the depth that we have. And there's a number of them that are started in Minnesota also, but they're not in the concept that we've got as far as our zones that we're putting together. They're more of a traditional kind of playground with all the equipment smashed in together in one little area kind of thing. So it's a little bit different.
So with the construction of this park, what kind of message are you hoping to send to the rest of the state and the rest of the country, for that matter, about the kind of place that La Crosse is?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we started out with, and we utilize that in our mission statement, is that, you know, this park is built for everybody, and it's designed to bring children, family, and loved ones of all ages and ability levels to enjoy the many benefits in outdoor play and recreation. And for the city of La Crosse, we feel like we're the leader, especially on the western part of the state of Wisconsin. But I think that this park is going to show not only Wisconsin, the Midwest, and the country, and that's how much we feel that this park is going to make a difference in the lives of many, many children, and that it just stands out so much. We feel it's going to be a big plus for employment, that if there's individuals that have children with autism or some kind of disability, that may be looking at the park and say, hey, we want to live in this kind of area. So it's a big plus. It really is.
Fran Formanek, president of the All Abilities Train Park Project, thanks for joining us today and telling us about this thing.
Well, thank you. And also, you can find, we have a website, and just go to trainpark.com. And we also have a Facebook page there that really shows you everything about our project from the start to where we're at right now.
Got it. Thank you so much, Fran. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Actress Viola Davis recently wrote a sequel to the much-beloved children's book Corduroy. The book was so important to her as a child and still as an adult because the character was an African-American girl. As the morning show continues, we'll talk about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on, we'll also explore how libraries and schools can address this issue. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? Parents, do you talk to your children about gender and race? Which books do you use to have this conversation? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Louise Amarez is professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. Louise, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you.
When do children start forming perceptions of gender and race?
Well, it looks like children start noticing kind of race, or at least paying attention to racial features, as early as 3 or 4 months. That they start looking more at the sorts of faces that they've seen in their environment, their caregivers. So it's something that they start noticing really early, and they start kind of forming theories about, particularly if we don't talk to them about it.
So what factors go into helping children form their understandings?
Well, I think parents talking to them about it, using books and television as ways of kind of showing that different types of people matter, that we can sort of watch and admire and enjoy kind of images of different groups, and being willing to kind of label and discuss them. And certainly, you know, there's plenty of research that suggests that African-American and Hispanic and even Asian-American families do that. White families often have somewhat less comfort doing that.
And why is that? Do we know?
Well, I think it often comes from pretty good intentions, as well as some kind of level of discomfort, you know, that is, I mean, it makes perfect sense why, say, African-American families do talk about it, because they want to kind of assure their kids that they matter, you know, and we know that, say, African-American kids and Hispanic or Asian-American kids notice that there are fewer representations, and they care. They want to see characters and content that captures them in some way. Whereas white parents, I think often they're worried that they're going to make their kid racist, actually, if they kind of name or point out the characters are or aren't of different races or ethnicities. And so it might come from a good place, but it's not necessarily a great thing.
What evidence is there that children connect the positive or negative representations of gender and race to their understanding of themselves?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I think one is that minority kids will sort of speak about wanting to see depictions of themselves, or feeling saddened or disheartened when all they see are kind of negative representations. I think on the other hand, I think gender role stereotypes play roles too, right? That kind of perceptions of what's appropriate for a boy to do or a girl to do can be pretty powerful, particularly when kids go through this kind of phase of really kind of carving out those boundaries of boys versus girls, which is like around 3 to 5. It's often pretty potent as a divider. So I think, you know, it matters that there's representations and that there's varied representations so that kids can kind of connect across these kind of multiple dimensions. So, for example, when Dora came out, when Latino kids were watching and researchers were like, how similar do you feel to Dora? You know, the Latino boys were like, well, no. I mean, yes, she's Latino, but I'm a boy and she's a girl and I want someone that's me, you know. So it's a complicated but important kind of area.
Well, and when it comes to gender, I mean, oftentimes, that the imaging there starts practically from birth. Girls get to have a lot of pink in their room, and boys, it's blue. I mean, those are just cultural traditions, at least in Western culture. And it's like these are just cultural norms. They're accepted. How do we deal with some of that?
Well, I think by kind of allowing kids to kind of graze freely, by offering them some alternatives, and by kind of noticing when we make assumptions or sort of steer them towards things. I mean, for example, when I would play with my kids in the aisles at Target, I would notice sometimes that boys, young boys, were like attracted to Barbie. And in a way, who wouldn't be attracted to Barbie? She's like incredibly glitzy, you know, but parents sometimes seem pretty uncomfortable with the idea that their little boy wanted a glitzy Barbie. And so thinking about why we're uncomfortable about that and kind of, you know, whether it would in fact be fine or just as problematic for a boy to have Barbie as it would be for a girl to have Barbie, I think it's kind of useful to reflect on what we're thinking.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, the assumption there is if boys want to play with Barbie, that must mean they're gay.
Yeah, might well be that kind of fear. And thinking through, like, well, really? Do I really think that if a boy is going to play with Barbie, that's going to somehow make him gay? And second, kind of, why would I sort of be concerned if my kid is gay? It's not like, you know. So I think, thinking through and kind of reflecting on that is useful.
There are a lot of landmines out there. We're talking about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on this hour, we'll talk about how public libraries and schools are addressing this issue. My guest is Louise Mares, professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? And parents, how do you talk to your children about gender and race? We'd like to hear from you this morning. What's your story? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So all of these, the representations, negative or positive, of various gender and race imagery, that has to have some sort of impact on the self-esteem of children. Talk a little bit about what is that impact and how does that manifest itself?
Well, I think media are part of a larger kind of set of messages about who matters. And kind of what's possible. And I think it's really important that all parents have kind of content that they can use to assure their kid, you matter, you're important, here's where you come from, here are kind of people, here's your history, and here's what you can be. And to kind of have books and paintings and TV content that they can use to support that. And there's plenty of research that suggests that parents having those kind of conversations with their kid helps their kid feel sort of better about themselves, feel supported, and kind of more resilient when they do in fact face kind of prejudice in society.
Actress Viola Davis loved the book Corduroy because she felt represented by the character who was a black girl. She still remembers that book all these years later, and it was so important to her that she wrote a sequel. Now, this seems like an example of how media and representation can stick with us well beyond childhood. How far-reaching are the lessons we learn from media?
Oh, I think they can be tremendously important. I think that a single character, as you say, can kind of last forever in one's head and kind of be someone that felt like a friend for years, who offered kind of hope about what was possible. And so I think these can be really strong and powerful connections. And I think then we have to give kids some options, right? It can't just be that one character has to take kind of all the possibilities for all the kids out there, because kind of within a given racial or gender group, there are lots of kids with different experiences. So we need, lots of options for kids to have hope.
Can you give us some examples of children's TV shows or books that are good examples of how diversity can be best addressed with children?
Well, I think, for example, it's great that we have Doc McStuffins, who is, you know, a young African-American character, kind of the lead rather than just kind of a minor sidekick. I think it was great that there was Kailan for a while as Chinese American. But I think one thing that's interesting about these things is while these shows can be kind of obvious and transparent, say, to minority kids, for white kids or kids who aren't members of that group, sometimes they're not necessarily as clear, and kids need adults to kind of point out connections, like, oh, you know, Dora speaks Spanish like Joey in your class, you know, get it?
Mm-hmm. All right. Louise Maris is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. We're talking about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on in the hour, we'll also explore how public libraries and schools are addressing this issue. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. How does diverse representation in children's literature and media impact children's perception of gender and race? Well, that's what we're talking about this hour on The Morning Show. Later on, we'll explore how public libraries and schools address this issue. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? Parents, how do you talk to your children about issues of gender and race? Which books or programs do you use to help you with this conversation? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Louise Maris is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content, and she's with us this morning to talk about these issues. Louise, you've studied how children and parents approach discussions of diversity. What have you observed?
Well, I think that often parents are surprised at what their kids are thinking, because often when their kids are thinking, you're not what the parents sort of think. And so, for example, white kids often don't notice that or understand, for example, that Dora's meant to be Latino. When I would ask them, you know, where may Dora have come from, they'd be like, well, she's speaking French, but she comes from the other Madison. You know, so there'd be these sort of deep confusions about what exactly that was meant to represent. So I think having more conversations would be great, and then having more options, particularly for some groups that remain really underrepresented, like Native Americans on television, virtually no images, particularly for children, of that experience.
Well, when we think about it, it makes perfect sense that children would see the world that way, because their worldview is based on our worldview, and our perceptions are based on what we've experienced so far, and so young children just wouldn't have a lot of experience and a lot of other input to tell them what they should think, unlike adults, who've had a lifetime to accumulate the things that go into how we perceive the world. So knowing this, then, how do families approach this conversation differently based on their own racial makeup?
Well, I think it would be, I'm really glad you're speaking to a librarian next, because I think libraries and books have this tremendous role that you can kind of seek out content that shows different, as well as your own group, right? And then kind of use it to kind of discuss, look at, point to pictures, sort of observe what's different and the same about their experiences in the book compared to your own, and kind of be willing to actually give kids language or to ask them what they think, and then get a sense of, like, how confused they are about kind of what that character is supposed to mean, I think it's really useful. I think parents are way more willing to say that's a boy or that's a girl, and much less willing to say that character's black or that character's Native American. And so being willing to do that and then to kind of listen to the kid ask questions and answer them, I think can be really powerful.
So what happens for children in the absence of conversations and experiences with different races?
Well, I think one thing they learn is that this is a really uncomfortable topic, that if adults kind of don't want to mention it, in fact, kind of skip past questions or just kind of seem blithely to prefer not to talk about it, then that this is somehow problematic. And so I think, in a way, expressing comfort, being willing to talk about it, being willing to kind of show that you're comfortable interacting and with people of different races and ethnicities is part of actually achieving what parents want, which is that their kid has that level of comfort and ease in the world.
Well, and modeling behavior is always crucial in childhood development. And I think, you know, parents, they gain an understanding, if they don't have it right off the bat, that children observe and see much more than we think they do.
Absolutely. They really do. You know, in fact, there's some research suggesting that kind of what parents say, particularly for preschool age kids, is even somewhat less important than kind of their body language, the kind of warmth with which adults are seen interacting across racial and ethnic lines. And so kind of the best predictor of kids' kind of racial attitudes are kind of whether the mom has friends of different races and ethnicities. So we are sending messages to our kids. And we kind of need to think a little bit about what those messages are, because the absence of kind of explicit modeling or explicit conversations is actually a pretty powerful message.
So the whole thing can just become sort of a taboo.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of sad and dangerous.
We're talking about how diverse representation in children's literature and media impact children's perception of gender and race with Louise Amarez, a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. We'd like you to respond to our media content, joining our conversation here at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. So do race and gender need to be frankly discussed with children, or is it possible for them to form an understanding by the mere presence of diversity? So let's say that mom and dad have a diverse group of friends, and they are around people of different ethnicities and maybe even different gender roles. If we don't talk to them about it specifically, can just our behavior make the complete picture here?
Well, I think our behavior has a huge impact. Yeah, and I think parents having a diverse group of friends, great. I think kids seeing those warm, friendly interactions is probably going to be the most powerful thing there is. But I think in the absence of that, because, you know, not everyone has diverse groups of friends, or to complement that, I think using media, but then using media mindfully and being willing to talk about it, can be also really useful. But assuming that kids will somehow just be able to know that this character is meant to connect in these ways to the kids I see at school or in preschool, that I think is a mistake. I think, for example, TV depictions are often animated, and those sort of images, those animated images, are clear to us, but not necessarily clear to children.
How does diversity of children's authors and TV show producers or writers have an impact on the content that we see?
Oh, I think that's clearly tremendously important. Sort of questions of authenticity and even just thinking about kind of the particularities. And what I mean by particularities is kind of getting the details right. Like, so when Viola Davis talks about caring about Lisa, the character in Corduroy, I mean, what matters, right, is that this girl is dressed and looks and behaves in this very sort of nice, beautiful, identifiable way. And so getting the details right so that a kid can identify with that person, I think is tremendously important.
What tips do you have for parents for having the kinds of frank conversations we're suggesting with their children?
Well, I think thinking about kind of sitting down, making it part of your evening routine or whatever, right? Having an array of books that you help your kid pick out from the library or whatever, or sitting and watching the TV shows and saying, just occasionally asking questions like, well, where do you think, you know, say Doc lives, where, you know, who is she like in your class? You know, do you notice that Doc's African-American like your friend Sarah is, you know? And being willing to use the language, I think, and being comfortable about it, I think is really helpful.
We have a caller who wants to join us. Let's hear from Liz, who's calling us in from southeastern Wisconsin. Liz, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to the program, and the reverse of what's being discussed is happening at my child's school. She goes to a very small school in a very small community, and I purposefully take her out there. But every race is represented at this school, where there is a total from kindergarten to eighth grade, 50 students. All of the kids play together of all the age groups. And I had commented to my best friend last year, how will we explain to the kids when they get out of this school that this scenario is not how it's going to be in all places in the great big world? And our English teacher this year assigned for the seventh and eighth graders a book called Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. And so that kind of got some of the kids thinking, well, why is this happening there? And that has led to the discussion of your different colors might not always be.
Okay. We're running out of, Liz, we're running out of time, and I'd like to give our guest a chance to respond. Louise?
I think it's great your kid is going to such a diverse school. I think I love that you're bringing up that a book can offer kind of a chance to have insight and empathy about prejudice and kind of have kind of this vicarious experience of what that feels like, and to recognize that it's not all friendship, that there are really negative experiences out there and what that might be like.
Louise Mares, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Louise Mares is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Coming up next on The Morning Show, we explore how one library system in Wisconsin is working to address representation and diversity in the literature available to children in their community. We welcome your participation in the program. Get a hold of us at 800-642-1234. What's happening in your community? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about how issues of representation and diversity in literature are available to children in their communities. Librarians and teachers, how do you teach your students about experiences and people different from them? Let us know, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Beth McIntyre is a librarian at Madison Public Library. She works to develop and update the library's collection. Beth, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, John.
So how do libraries play a role in children's development?
There's kind of three basic ways libraries, kind of public libraries I'm talking about right now, play a role in children's development. One is access to materials. We try to build these kind of large, diverse collections that especially kids who are in the pre-reading stage and children who are learning to read can just have a ton of options. I think parents who have a child who just started to learn to read all know how exciting that is and how you just want to tear through anything you can get your hands on. And libraries really kind of provide kind of access to anything a kid might want to read without kind of that financial obligation on the part of the parents. They can just get as many kids' books as their kids, you know, want in their hands during that really exciting time. Another way that libraries kind of support child development is through intentional programming for kids of all ages, but, you know, especially focusing on kind of early literacy and, you know, child development at that stage, and then through kind of strategic partnerships with other organizations in the community that are kind of doing the same type of work.
So let's talk about the Madison Public Library specifically. What kind of programming and children's literacy initiatives do you have?
Well, you know, I can speak from my end as a collection development librarian, which is kind of building collections and creating access. You know, we are very, very intentional about what we buy, what we display, what we put face out, so that any child walking into our library, I mean, we can't make the promise that any child can find something that kind of reflects their experience, because, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of what's published. But we, you know, we go out of our way to be very, very intentional about what we purchase. There's kind of an old saying in children's literature that children need mirrors and windows, and that's always kind of what we're trying to provide, a window into someone else's life and a mirror to reflect your own experience.
And do you know, do public schools attempt to follow similar standards in their libraries?
They do. They definitely do. You know, I can't speak, you know, super detailed about, you know, MMSD or any school district's kind of policies or initiatives, but school librarians are really in there putting in the work of supporting the curriculum in their school, supporting the teachers in their school to try to find, you know, reflective literature for all children. And then also they have that kind of like captive audience of one-on-one with all of those kids, and those partnerships that the public library and the school library kind of do to do wraparound services all year are a really, really important part of both of our jobs.
We're talking with Beth McIntyre, librarian at the Madison Public Library, talking about how issues of representation and diversity in literature are available to children in our communities. Beth, how do you ensure that you are serving a diverse audience?
You know, when we are kind of putting together programming and, you know, getting materials in the library, I know that I have to, if I kind of follow the, you know, kind of traditional way of collection development, which is kind of the mainstream professional, you know, kind of journals and publications that, you know, speak to these things, sometimes, you know, you can still end up with a bit of a homogenous collection. And so, you know, it's part of a librarian's job to be very intentional of kind of going outside that stream, of finding voices from your own community and different communities across the country that are lifting up diverse voices to make sure you're getting those books in your collection, or that you're, you know, getting the types of programming people are looking for.
I want to go back, loop back, and follow up on something you said earlier about, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of what's available. Mm-hmm. Is there a lack of diversity in children's book authors or the publishing industry that might perpetuate the lack of diversity we might see in characters in children's literature?
Absolutely. The Cooperative Children's Book Center, that I think I might have gotten that mixed up, the CCBC here at the UW does a lot of great work every year with kind of keeping statistics of diversity in publishing. And the truth of the matter is it hasn't really gotten that much better since the 1960s. You know, things are kind of slowly growing, and in the children's lit world there are a lot of organizations and kind of initiatives that have sprung up over the past few years to draw attention to diversity in children's literature, to try to kind of promote, you know, you know, kind of more publishing and more we call own voices, which is, you know, someone from a marginalized or, you know, minority community writing their own stories and having their own stories published. But it does take intentionality to try to get those books. You might not always find them in the same mainstream channels. So, you know, it's something that librarians have to work at, but it's part of our job.
What is the Library Bill of Rights?
The Library Bill of Rights is kind of a collection of guiding principles developed by the American Library Association that kind of govern services to libraries, all kinds of libraries in the United States. So it kind of talks about, it's just kind of a set of ground rules. For an example, you know, materials are going to be provided for the interest, information, and enlightenment of all people in the community that the library serves. It addresses things like censorship, that, you know, libraries should be on the front lines of challenging censorship and provide materials that, promote different points of view and opposing points of view. That's something that libraries have always taken really seriously, and it's right there kind of in our Bill of Rights.
You know, I was thinking as we were talking about this a little, how my mother took me by the hand and mm-hmm. walked me down to what was then the Carnegie Free Library in the tiny town of Hayward, Wisconsin, and introduced me to the world of books. And I think it's appropriate as we come to the end of this hour that we talk about how parents play a role in the diversity of experiences and teachings their kids encounter. Talk about that a little bit. What is the parental role here? And what advice do you have for parents?
Absolutely. And John, I just want to let you know that little story you told is the type of, like, tell that story anytime you're talking to a librarian. We love that sort of thing. when you're thinking about books, that even when you're taking a trip to the library with your kid and you're picking up books together, put some books in your bag that aren't about a child that looks like your child, especially if your child is kind of part of the dominant, like, white middle-class culture that exists in children's books. You don't have to always make a huge deal about it. You're there to hear stories, and you're there to hear all sorts of stories. So make some room in your library bag for just different types of things. See what sticks, see what's interesting. And always leave, room in the library bag for choice of the child, because you'll, always be interested. You'll always be surprised by what they kind of pick up and are interested in themselves.
And if you don't know exactly what it is you're looking for,
ask a librarian.
Always ask a librarian. There you go.
That's what we're there for.
Well, we kind of don't think about that all the time, though. When we go in, and it's okay, here's the library, kids. Take a look at what you'd like to read, and just have at it. I'm going to go look at this magazine.
Absolutely, and we field a lot of questions we are a resource, and we're here for the community. We field a lot of questions from grandparents around the holidays. I want to buy my child a gift. What's good? We're there for you, and if we don't know the answer, we will find it.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Beth McIntyre is a librarian at Madison Public Library. She works to develop and update the library's collection. The Morning Show is produced by Sarah Hopeful, Chris Molina, Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, and Brianne Chasso. Keely Boltina is executive producer. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network.